Moments ago, President Trump declaring a state of emergency. This from the White House gardens there on the Rose Garden, delivering his remarks. Here is a quick clip. I know, show open, Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network in a very soggy studio, recovering from torrential downpours here. Last few days, it's felt as though a tropical storm has blown through Southern California. So don't worry, we are dry and not high. So here we go. I want to get right into this. It's so timely. And I know my best takes are my hot takes. Producer Robbie shaking his head. Anyway, here's Trump moments ago, and this is what he said about declaring national emergency.
The order is signed, and I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban.
It's a rap song. Literally, he's rapping in the press conference. Yep. How can you not love this guy? Well, the answer is there's a lot of people that don't love this guy, and we're going to get into just who some of those characters are as the program unfolds. But already, people on both sides of the aisle have expressed their opinions about this move. So here's where we're at. We've got today was the deadline for the budget. New budget needed to be signed, and it's a $330-odd billion budget, of which they're appropriating $1.375 billion to erect some physical barriers along the border. So it's not zero, but it's a far cry from the $5 and change billion that the president had been requesting. Now, I want us to put a slight, just a pin in that for a minute, because I'm going to come back to the significance of why it's important that they appropriated some money. Because it will go to the heart of why some pundits on the right, like Ann Coulter, for example, are dead wrong. Coulter tweeted out as soon as news was breaking. She didn't even wait for the press conference. She tweeted out this morning when it was smoke signals had been sent out by the Trump administration that the president was going to declare the emergency, sign the budget, declare the emergency, and get the wall built via the emergency declaration. And Coulter went out and said, you know, this Trump's just appealing to his stupidest voters with this promise that I'm fighting for this, but really he knows he's in a battle he cannot win. Now, the question of whether it's a battle the president can win comes down to the law. And the law here, I hate to say this, you know, when you're in a dicey situation, I'm not going to lie, this is a dicey situation. And I, as a in principle, of course, honor and respect the separation of powers in our government. But I will always go to the law and to the way the law has been interpreted by past Supreme Court decisions to determine whether or not a particular move, a political move, falls within the boundaries of the law. And here, the measure of this, of whether or not the president is going to succeed in his efforts ultimately in getting this this emergency declaration to be sustained, as he put it, after it goes through the various appellate courts that are filled with liberal leftist hacks. So we're going to disregard what they say. But ultimately, it will come to a Supreme Court that, if I can remind you of this, back in 2016, shot down President Obama in his effort to use executive power back in 2014, November 20th of 2014. Remember his Dreamer executive order, where he unilaterally basically permitted Dreamers to for their stays to be extended, gave them protections under the law, circumvented Congress. And that went, you know, that went through the courts and ultimately went to the Supreme Court. And because Justice Scalia had just passed away, there was only 8 members in the court. It was a 4-4 decision. When there's a tie like that, the law will get struck down. So it was upheld. So sorry, it was the 4-4 decision. It gets upheld. So here's where we're at with this. There is a case, goes back some 60 odd years, called Youngstown Sheet and Steel, I believe is the name of the company. It doesn't matter, but this case is the seminal case on presidential power as it relates to Congress. And there's 3 areas, right? There's 3 different scenarios where the president acts. And the degree to which he's able to act as, I would say unilaterally, if you will, or as a sovereign authority, depends on the extent to which Congress has meddled in the issue, if you will. So there's scenario 1. Congress has expressly forbidden, right, whatever it is that the president wants to have done. And that, in that scenario, presidential power, as recognized by the courts constitutionally, is at its weakest. The president can really, if Congress has specifically said, we want X, and the president then does the exact opposite, probably going to get struck down. Virtually 100% chance of that happening. Now, the second scenario is the twilight zone, if you will, right? The twilight zone is where Congress has been unclear. Maybe they've had a pronouncement or two about it. Maybe they haven't. Maybe they've passed conflicting laws. Okay, or given conflicting directives about how they feel about a particular issue. And that's the 50-50 toss-up, if you will. And in the third scenario, in this particular case, Youngstown, which I promise you will be the touchstone of how this executive order of the president's gets determined, the third area is where the president and Congress are in unison, right? They're arm in arm. They're going forward. They're doing it. And their presidential power is at its zenith. Highest level, if you will. So where are we? I'm going to point something very important out that y'all have to remember. And that is, when we're talking about Congress, we're not talking about today's Congress as it looks today, on February 15th, 2019. We are not just talking about this newly installed Congress with Nancy Pelosi at its helm. They will look back a series of years and look at what the historical positions have been of Congress as it relates to directives and permissions given to the executive branch to secure the border. And as far as I can tell, there have been a number of directives. And remember, in this whole discussion, right, when people on the Trump side of the argument say, what, these Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, they were all for building border barriers. They were all for building fencing and wall, if you will, when Obama was president. And I'll remind you that Obama was president and not that long ago. And it's true that in certain acts that were passed by Congress, the executive branch, which, of course, back then did not have President Trump installed, but rather President Obama. The 2006 Secure Fences Act, that was under Bush, too. That was something where Congress gave the president extensive powers to build and secure the border, build walls and secure the border. The Immigration and Nationality Act, another piece of legislation, gave the president a plenary right to exclude illegal aliens from the United States. So you start to look back at all the different instances where Congress has said, yeah, absolutely. The executive branch, the president, you know, the White House, that guy and those people inside that building can do and take steps to secure the border. Now, I want to point out something else. How is the court going to look at Congress giving the president $1.375 billion? See, the negotiators on Capitol Hill think that this is a huge win for them, right? The president wanted $6 billion. They're basically giving him, they're sending him off with some chump change, little pittance, walking around town money. How much wall is he going to build? I've heard 60 miles, 50 miles, whatever it is. Not a lot. But critically, to the legal analysis of this, it wasn't a hard no, was it? So when I'm looking at Youngstown, I'm looking at this old, old Supreme Court decision, which is still good law. And I look at this and I say, well, Congress didn't give the president a hard no. So it's not going to be in that 100% the president is acting outside the direction given him by Congress. Because Congress actually here is appropriating money specifically for the purpose to build wall or build a physical barrier, whatever you want to call it. So to answer this tweet from Coulter and various other pronouncements by other conservatives who are apoplectic over the president caving on this and saying that this is just a dog whistle to his, stupid base. I disagree fundamentally. I don't think that this case legally is a slam dunk for the president, but I don't think it's a slam dunk for whatever state, whatever entity challenges it. Certainly will be, as Trump, so I think jokingly, right, but obviously truly put it, that it's going to get overturned in all these lower appellate courts and circuit courts that are stocked with nut job leftists. They're gonna venue shop this, right? That's whoever's gonna bring a claim to oppose this, maybe the state of California or somebody, right? Our Xavier Becerra, our attorney general, is going to file a lawsuit, and they're going to file it in a friendly court where they know they're gonna get an injunction, where they know they're gonna get some action. But as it progresses up through the courts, I think that this question becomes a lot more interesting. Now, a lot of people ask, well, Sam, it's a slam dunk. So you've got this court right now that's stacked with a bunch of, Republican appointees. And I'd be very careful about that, because the kind of justices, for example, the last two picks will look at the constitutionality of this. They're very likely to rule against Trump if they think that he's taking a liberty here that he shouldn't be. Now, as a side note, I will tell you that apparently Justice Ginsburg is back in the saddle and at the Supreme Court. She had a bit of a cancer scare and has reemerged. So, just in the nick of time for all of this to shake out. Nancy Pelosi, yesterday, in anticipation of Trump declaring a national emergency, went on the record with a little bit of a threat. Here's what she said.
It's important to note that when the president declares this emergency, first of all, it's not an emergency, what's happening at the border. It's a humanitarian challenge to us. But putting that aside, just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress. I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people. You want to talk about a national emergency? Let's talk about the epidemic of gun violence in America. That's a national emergency.
Whoa! So that is, well, that's a very thinly veiled threat. When we have President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at the White House, we will declare a gun emergency and go door to door confiscating everyone's pea shooters. But can we have fun with this statement for just a minute? Because I don't think that Nancy Pelosi realized she stepped in it. First of all, she's already laying out the way that they're going to challenge the president, which is they're going, you can see they're saying, well, it's not a national emergency, which, by the way, that's the language that you have to use or the bar you have to meet in order to trigger the act that gives the power to the president to act unilaterally. It's a, what does she call it? A humanitarian challenge. Okay, it's a humanitarian challenge that has morphed into an emergency. Well, whatever it is. Okay. But the better part of it is, says, okay, well, if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people, and then goes on to talk about guns. She is flat out admitting, I know I'm getting away from the border issue, but just, this is great, flat out admitting that every time the Democrats talk about the gun epidemic, that they're blowing, it's just smoke. She's admitted to it here. She's just, think about it. You know, if AOC is president, you know, maybe we could call the whole gun thing, a national emergency. By implication, the way she's setting it up, right? And I don't think she intended to do this. I just think the truth came out, right? That she's equating this pet issue of the Democratic Party to something she thinks is just hot air. All right. When we come back, Andrew McCabe, this may end up being the story of the year. And I will explain why. Don't go anywhere. I'll spend quite a bit of time on this. This, folks, is big stuff, and it's developing. Sam Rejofsky, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem, and Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Okay, folks, I'm going to sum up this Andrew McCabe nonsense in just a very simple way. 2 years now, we have been listening to the media pundits, the actors themselves, right? All the people that were inside the FBI or are inside the FBI, affiliated with those inside and outside, whatever. Everybody that has surrounded this cluster mess that has resulted in the appointment of Bob Mueller, this incredibly crazy but with no result investigation into Trump-Russia collusion. All of this, we've been told there was never, ever any reason for the FBI to want to take down Trump. I mean, that's not what this was about. And all of a sudden, I wake up yesterday to reports of Andrew McCabe, number two at the FBI, right, a deputy to sanctimonious Jim Comey, the fired FBI director, if you remember him, right? So McCabe, right, number two at the FBI, he is literally on 60 Minutes, CBS News, talking about how a group of high-ranking FBI agents, officials, if you will, got together to concoct a plan to take down the president. Now, you don't believe me, why don't we have a listen to what he has to say? Now, here's the actual full interview, I want to make this clear, is airing over the weekend. So all we have right now to work with are a few promo clips. Actually, I think there's only two. And this is McCabe speaking to Pelley, interview on 60 Minutes, and listen to what McCabe is saying here.
I was speaking to the man who had just run for the presidency and won the election for the presidency, and who might have done so with the aid of the government of Russia, our most formidable adversary on the world stage. And that was something that troubled me greatly.
Oh, it troubled you greatly. Now, I do note that you are, sir, a veteran of the FBI. I know that the media reports that over and over again as to tout the impartiality of your position. I'm curious that back, well, when was that? Let's see, 2012-ish, when President Obama whispered in Dmitry Medvedev's ear. Remember, Medvedev was briefly the president of Russia, sort of to break up the terms of Vladimir Putin, big crony of Putin's, his ally, basically allowing Putin to be the effective president. He went to be prime minister. Remember that whole deal? Anyway, Obama whispers on a hot mic to Dmitry Medvedev. You remember this? During the election, he goes, "Hey, Dmitry, you know, just cut me some slack. You know, I could be a lot more flexible in our dealings after the election." Remember that? But McCabe didn't then proceed upon learning of this information in the media. Very well, it was on audio, it was recorded, video and audio, so there's no doubt it was said. Certainly more evidence there of collusion than anything so far being raised by anything that Trump or his administration has done. But nonetheless, didn't do anything about it. And so Pelley, this is the craziest thing, right? So Pelley doesn't really even challenge any of this, right? And he goes, "How long was it after that that you decided to start the obstruction of justice and counterintelligence investigations involving the president?" And here's McCabe's answer.
"I think the next day I met with the team investigating the Russia cases, and I asked the team to go back and conduct an assessment to determine where are we with these efforts and what steps do we need to take going forward. I was very concerned that I was able to put the Russia case on absolutely solid ground in an indelible fashion, that were I removed quickly or reassigned or fired, that the case could not be closed or vanish in the night without a trace. I wanted to make sure that our case was on solid ground, and if somebody came in behind me and closed it and tried to walk away from it, they would not be able to do that without creating a record of why they'd made that decision."
I call BS. Folks, the only reason, now I'm not disputing that he did all that. He is literally admitting to planning to depose the president. Now, the reason that he has to now go full bore here is not his stated reason that it was for God and country, right? Protecting us from a Kremlin puppet in the body of Donald Trump. But it was because at this point, right, these guys had done so many dirty things to Trump under Obama's direction during the campaign. Remember all those FISA warrants? Remember the wiretapping, if you will, of Trump Tower? All that BS. Do you understand the fear of God that McCabe had in his heart for his own skin? The only way that any of these cats thought that they were going to live to see another day and avoid, frankly, not just losing their jobs, but getting fired, getting indicted, right, was if they could get rid of Trump. And the transfer of attention from their own misdeeds began there. And you'll hear a lot about these fateful 8 days. And in the media, it's being reported just in the context of what it meant to the president. But I submit to you here and now, it is not just about what it meant to the president, but certainly it ultimately, so far, has damaged the president more than any other player in this. But now you're going to see that it all is a giant CYA operation. Those initials stand for cover your A money effort to protect those who had totally abused their powers under the Obama administration, had absolutely believed that Hillary would become president and were in a frantic OF my, you know what? Trump is president now and all of the things that we did wrong and illegally will come to light. And that is what this is all about. Sam Brzozowski, I'll be back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Brzozowski, making radio great again here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Now, as a funny side note, a great deal of this persona that Andrew McCabe, the ex-FBI official, number two at the FBI under James Comey, is made of his independent right credentials. He's not a political person. He's not a Hillary guy or whatnot. You must know that all of that is 100% hogwash. And I will just remind you here that, yeah, you want to know what's funny? So his wife, you know, his wife ran for Senate in Virginia. Andrew McCabe's wife, yeah, so this was, this happened. When did she run? Jill McCabe. I don't remember. Was it 2 years? Was it in like 2016? Did she run in 2016? But at any rate, you've got to know. You've got to know something. Was it 2018? Well, I think it was 2016. At any rate, do you know the craziest thing here is, do you know who first reached out to her? Supposedly, and this is according to an op-ed piece that she wrote in the Washington Post on April 2nd of last year. So Jill McCabe setting a record straight. This is after her husband, Andrew, gets fired. She goes on to set the record straight. Says, hey, I'm not a political person, not at all. I just got picked out of the blue. The lieutenant governor of Virginia calls me and asks me to run. Now, guess who that would have been? Well, yeah, those of you who know Virginia politics know it was none other than Ralph Northam, Mr. Blackface himself, the guy who's governor now. And after that contact, guess who was next to reach out to Jill McCabe? That would have been who? Terry McAuliffe, who was then governor of Virginia, but he was also a longtime Clinton political operative. Now, what was going on during all of this? A preparation for the big election, right? The big 2016 race, a presidential race. And what was the issue du jour? The issue du jour was Hillary Clinton's email scandal. The fact that she had all this stuff out there that she had deleted and was going to be the subject, right, of a criminal investigation. Now, who performs this type of investigation? The FBI. Now, no investigation has been done into this, but the whole thing stinks to high heaven. Now, all the guy who's number two at the FBI, his wife, out of obscurity, right? All she is a doctor. I'm not saying that's nothing, but she's not a politician. She is a pediatric doctor, maybe working at a hospital, and suddenly gets a call out of the blue from the state's highest elected Democrats, the two highest elected Democrats, saying, you should run. And by her own admission in this Washington Post op-ed, I'm not a political person. I have no political connections. Yeah, woman. Well, why do you think they called you? They called you because they needed to use you. And most importantly, they needed leverage with your husband. And they got it. And all this drivel about, in her pieces, she writes that Andrew McCabe was a reliable Republican and that he, I don't know, that he'd voted for both Republican and Democrats. She says that in two separate sentences that are joined together. I mean, okay, so a reliable Republican, huh? And then he voted for Republicans and Democrats. It's a farce, folks. The whole thing, this whole thing stinks to high heaven. And it's absolutely clear that Hillary Clinton, through Terry McAuliffe, who's a known and established and reliable, if I can use that word, reliable Clinton crony, they funneled a bunch of millions of dollars to Jill McCabe's campaign. Did she win? No, she lost. And then, to add insult to injury, McCabe is now whining. Have you heard this? McCabe is whining then during one of his first meetings with President Trump. Trump asks him, hey, so how was it for your wife to lose an election? And he goes, oh, well, it was pretty hard. Yeah, how must it be to be a loser? I'll explain that when we come back. Sam Rejofsky, don't go anywhere.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
All right, Sam Rejofsky here. So yeah, this Fox News yesterday wrote they're referencing a piece that was published in The Atlantic where McCabe detailed a discussion with President Trump where Trump apparently mocked his wife as a loser. Quote, he said, how is your wife? I said, she's fine. He said, when she lost her election, that must have been very tough to lose. How did she handle losing? Is it tough to lose? McCabe says, I replied, I guess it's tough to lose anything, but she's rededicated herself to her career and her job and taking care of kids in the emergency room. I'm not laughing at that as a state. I'm just saying, I'm sure that's exact. What amount of credibility do you give to the fact that this is exactly how the conversation went down? Yeah, when people start to say, oh, you know, I mean, because look, if somebody says to me, I don't care if it's the president of the United States, and they say to me, hey, how does it feel your wife to be a loser? I mean, you got to be pretty damn good to then immediately whip around an answer like this. I guess it's tough to lose anything, but she's rededicated herself to her career and blah, 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 blah. I'm going to call BS on that. But anyway, then Trump said, quote, in a tone that sounded like a sneer, he said, yeah, that must have been really tough to lose, to be a loser. Close quote. Okay, what do you think? I'm asking, what do you think of that? I think there's really two scenarios, right? It either happened that way or it didn't happen that way. If it happened that way, why? Well, Trump already knows that this is the FBI that let Hillary Clinton off the hook. This is the FBI that, quote unquote, tapped his phones in Trump Tower. This is the FBI that's alleging that he colluded with Russia, because we had a series of leaks that were coming out during this time where there were concerns at the highest levels of the DOJ that Trump was, you know, had gotten Russian bot farms or remember all that stuff. Anyway, so you all think Trump's an idiot, right? So I get you go, well, how could he just go into the room and storm in like that? But he's testing this guy. He's pushing his buttons. And that's to assume that Trump really said it. What do I think? I think it went down something like that. I do. I'm not sure that McCabe was as artful in his responses. That I doubt. But I am positive Well, I know Trump. I know his approach when he is pissed off. And I know he certainly was going to needle these guys and get a reaction out of them. I don't know that Trump ever expected that the next step would be to ask Rod Rosenstein to wire up, go into the Oval Office to eavesdrop or to obtain intelligence, counterintelligence against the president. That we know is going to be coming out in the interview this weekend. McCabe said as much, and we know that because Scott Pelley, who did the interview, talks about this here. So who's interviewing? Gail King's asking him about it because Rosenstein said the whole wire thing was a joke, right? He goes, oh, haha, we were just sitting around shooting the you-know-what, because this is what I guess FBI, high-up FBI agents do, go, hey, we should wear a wire when we go see Obama. Anyway, so McCabe apparently says it was not a joke. Here's the question and the answer by Scott Pelley.
And this was not perceived to be a joke.
This was not perceived to be a joke. Mm-hmm. It was also said at a previous time that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, offered to wear a wire into the White House to record potentially incriminating conversations with the president. A statement was released after that was never serious, it was sarcastic, etc. McCabe, in our interview, says no. It came up more than once, and it was so serious that he took it to the lawyers at the FBI to discuss it.
What this tells me, and it's what I said a little bit earlier, what it tells me is that you have McCabe doubling down on all of this. No, it wasn't a joke. We were serious. My concerns, you know, on a scale of 1 through 10, my concerns were 20, okay? Because he is facing the fight of his life. When they look back at these FISA warrants, when they look back to how the DOJ was handled managed under the last, let's just say the last couple years, 3 or 4 years of the Obama administration. I do think it tells us something about a big change that is coming to the DOJ. I'm going to try not to read too many tea leaves, but I'll do that right when we come back because everybody's asking me about this one thing, this one staffing change and what I think of it. And so I will give you my thoughts when we return. Don't go anywhere. Back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Murjowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Murjowski, okay. Yesterday, Valentine's Day, something happened in the Senate. And no, it wasn't Dianne Feinstein clutching her pearls. No, William Barr was confirmed in a 54-45 vote, largely along party lines, as the new attorney general. So he is now the official permanent attorney general replacing Jeff Sessions. Now, a lot of people have been asking me, what do I make of this pick? And of course, I am naturally distrustful of anyone who says as part of his first introduction that his wife and Bob Mueller's wife go to the same Bible study group. I'm going to get some flack for them. First of all, I'm generally distrustful of attorneys who are very religious. Religion and the Constitution oftentimes don't mesh very well. But putting that aside, what Trump needs is not a creature of Washington. What Trump needs is not someone who is beholden to maintaining status quo. But the fact that McCabe's timing here, I realize there's a book, right? And I realize that when you write a book, you've got to sell the book. When you've gotten fired from your big job at the FBI and you're kind of mired in some controversy and you may not immediately have access to a great paying job, you got to write a book. You've got to monetize the whole experience that you've been through. So that's what's going on. And to some extent, of course, this media blitz that he's doing and the 60 Minutes interview that's coming out over the weekend is an effort to promote the book. But his vehement doubling down could also be a signal that he fears, because he knows who William Barr is better than any of us, right? I mean, unless you're a Washington insider, he knows what his level of exposure is, what he's done wrong, and how likely this new, we'll call it this new sheriff, right? This new guy that is the head of the FBI, the DOJ, as Attorney General, how far he's likely to investigate this. And I don't know if you can recall this, because this goes back to last year and we deal in week to week or day to day news cycles. But if you recall, you remember that the independent inspector general, who I think, if I recall, was big, fairly reliable, there's the word again, Democrat, really threw the book at McCabe in his testimony on Capitol Hill. You remember this? You had that guy that, it was the inspector general at the DOJ, and he really laid it out against McCabe. And at the time, you know, you had Sessions crippled by virtue of his recusal. You had, for all intents and purposes, Rod Rosenstein acting as the attorney general. But Rod Rosenstein, as you know, is knee deep in all this poo-poo. So nothing was happening. Maybe, and again, I told you I didn't want to read too many tea leaves, but just maybe, McCabe is now going on the record very loudly and very proudly to offer clear motive, acting in national best interest and security and da-da-da-da-da, because he fears that this new appointment, William Barr, Attorney General, may start to clean house. I don't know. I remain very skeptical. I know we were all told that there was no one more impeccably suited and more moral and more honorable than Bob Mueller, and that we had nothing to fear, and we've now seen how that's all shaken out. All righty. Boy, there's been some local news. I still want to share also a few stories from my trip to D.C. I know we kind of glossed through it. We had so much news last week to cover, I didn't get to everything. So I'll share a few of those nibbles and dribbles for you. So just don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Back after this. Sam Rogowski on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
We shall fight on the airwaves. We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Hey, you know, if you thought last week Jeff Bezos had, you know, kind of a rough time with the Inquirer digging around in his crotch shots, I think maybe this past week was a little bit worse. You heard what happened, right? Amazon has been plotting a second headquarters somewhere in the U.S., and a number of cities have been in the running, a number of locations. And I know that even my humble town of Irvine was under some, or Orange County was under some consideration for the project. And And it's a big deal. I mean, it brings about $4 billion, $3 to $4 billion in investment, 25,000 jobs. And with it, of course, a certain amount of tax revenue. Now, I want to explain this because the story, of course, is that after this nationwide search, all these cities in the running, I mean, how much did they spend on figuring out that they were going to do it in New York? I know it's Amazon. I know they print money, but still, you know, time is money and they need to move on it. And when they had a place, a site already picked out and they thought they had a deal, to then have it yanked by a bunch of goofball left-wing wackadoodle politicians led by none other than AOC herself, it's got a sting. It's got to sting even more than having Pecker's National Enquirer threaten to publish pictures of your man parts. So I want you to understand a little bit about how these projects work, right? Because every time a big company decides to move into a particular state or into a particular county or city, they are going to look for some tax advantages, which is, of course, lovely. I love that Bezos' Washington Post writes endlessly about how, you know, taxes need to be more fair and we, you know, the rich need to pay more. But, you know, but then Amazon, of course, wants a carve out. It was a $3 billion carve out in various tax exemptions from the state and from the local municipalities. But I want to explain how it actually helps the state. This is what, you know, AOC and her minions miss, right? Because if you take those 25,000 jobs, and I'm going to, it's a little spoiler alert here for this project. This isn't a warehouse, right? This is an office building, a series of office buildings. These are executives working for one of the biggest companies in the U.S. Are you following what I'm saying? So you move these poor people into New York, and let's do some quick math. Robbie, you got a calculator? Producer Robbie, he's getting a calculator. Let's do some quick math. 25,000 jobs, averaging, what would you say they average? $150 a year? $150K a year average? Okay. 25,000 times 150,000. Because what I'm trying to figure out here is what kind of annual income tax revenue the state is going to get off of these jobs, right? Annual. This is recurring. So we got 25K jobs times 150,000, and it's, you know, and it's New York, so they're going to get what, 20% of that? 25% of that. What do we got? We're working on it. We've got how much? $937 million. Now, let's just assume Robbie's going to crunch those numbers again. But for a second here, do you see how them giving up $3 billion, the state giving up $3 billion, if all Amazon has to do is stay in place for more than, we'll say, 3 years, for 4 years, and the state and the county and the city have added, theoretically, an extra $1 billion or $900 or $800 million to their coffers. So I want to point out the colossal stupidity. I'm anti-taxes from the start. So I think that this money is an atrocious grab to begin with. Amazon was shifting, very smart here, what they were doing. They were shifting the tax burden, the tax give, if you will, from themselves, from Jeff was taking, no, I'm not going to pay these taxes. I'm going to have my employees, by virtue of their payroll taxes, by virtue of their income taxes, etc., pay the state and make this a lucrative deal for the state that's going to accept us. If Bezos cared about his employees, he would put this thing in Florida, or he'd put it, you know, in Nevada or another state that has no income tax. But the reason that this project, one of the key reasons why this project was being considered in California and in New York, wasn't just because of the local workforce there. It was because the state would get significant tax revenues on a long-term basis, and the company would get the benefit of a tax relief, right? And this is why you saw Andrew Cuomo, who was the governor of New York, I mean, left-wing guy, right? Big-time Democrat. He went nuts. He basically said he wanted this deal to happen. This deal was good for the state of New York. He has jobs. These liberal nut jobs. This is why AOC is the best thing to ever happen to Trump and to the Republican Party. If she and her crazy cronies get their way and get, I mean, take over the Democratic Party, and Democratic Party becomes the party that sinks companies like Amazon going into states like New York. Well, that's it. What's the net exodus of jobs leaving New York every year? It's huge. And so, and here you got actually a Democratic governor attempting to bend over backwards to make this work, and got slammed by some activist politicians. I'll point out an example. There was one example of a server facility going in to Utah. This was in an area south of Salt Lake, and it was torpedoed. But I think there are instances where municipalities have to act in their self-interest. And the critical difference was that the server facility that was going into Utah, I think, had something like 3 jobs. Like, all it is a server facility, and they've got a couple of IT guys and a maintenance person on staff. It's not really a job producing business. It would have created just a little bit of short term, construction jobs and that kind of thing, and that would have all gone away. But the give, or I guess the ask by Facebook, was, you know, water rights and tax breaks for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it was. It just didn't make sense. There wasn't ultimately a net benefit for the municipality. And I understand that in those circumstances, if there's not a net benefit, then why is the municipality giving a tax break to Facebook? And at the same time, you know, charging its blue collar workers, you know, outrageous property taxes on their hard earned and hard fought for homes. So this is, you know, I'm not saying always it's wrong to say no to big companies, but this deal, sinking this deal, was outrageously stupid, and something that I think will. I'm telling you, they got to keep the. And if I were Nancy Pelosi and I were Chuck Schumer and I'm Steny Hoyer, who is the House Majority Leader, number two, if you will, to Nancy Pelosi. If I'm any of these people, I am terrified of this new class of radical representatives that have entered this freshman class. And you saw the deal with Ilhan Omar, right? Who's the congresswoman, I mean, just an outrageously anti-Semitic post. And then her non-apology response. This was having to do with Israel and Israel's efforts to lobby U.S. lawmakers. And I mean, it was awful. And it's not even thinly veiled anti-Semitism. It was basically going to the heart of negative stereotypes of Jewish people. And, the more of these wackadoodles that Nancy Pelosi has in her midst, I got her hands full. I think she feels it, too. I sense it. Did you notice 2 weeks ago with the when the new Green Deal was getting put together, stitched together, if you will, sort of in the back rooms of the House and of the Senate, AOC in the House and Senator Markey from Massachusetts kind of gave it his lifeless prop up. You know, I don't know if you remember this, but Nancy Pelosi specifically excluded AOC from the climate change committee. So you've got this young rising star who's getting a lot of press. And then Nancy Pelosi, Speakeress of the House, comes along and says, I don't think you're going to be on that committee. What you're seeing is a deliberate effort to push back and push down, because remember, in Washington, it still is all about seniority. And when you're a freshman congressman, the same is true for what Romney's doing. I mean, he's trying to be the voice of the Republican Party. And Mitch McConnell, I'm sure at some point, will either have the conversation or relay the message in some fashion that you're just a freshman senator, sir, and you got to kind of hold your horses and respect some protocol and procedure here. So this, I think, is going to be a big story as it develops this year, because there's going to be a huge clash and a confrontation, because Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and all these people who are these radical freshmen representatives are certainly not going to wait and let protocol play out its course. And I just grab some popcorn, because for those of you who think that the Republican Party is divided, just wait and see what's going to be happening on the other side of the aisle. Now, here's a humorous anecdote that I am now emotionally prepared to share with you from my little get together in Washington last week. I think I told you that I went to a series of pregame events. Think of this, I don't know if it's a fair comparison, but think of the State of the Union speech like a Super Bowl, okay? For all that talk that Nancy was going to kill the State of the Union speech. Now, this is the State of the Union speech is a big day, even for Nancy Pelosi and all these Democrats. So they have all these parties beforehand and get-togethers. And one of these parties was at the Library of Congress, which is right across the street from the Capitol. And in this party, there was a congressman, I won't name him, who was speaking to me and Ben McAdams, and he was saying that the Republican Party is in big trouble. Now, of course, my ears perked up, because I always like for the other side to tell me how we're in trouble, right? So I want to hear what they think. Well, what do you think that the consensus is on the Democratic side of why our party's in trouble? Because I would think our party's in trouble because people can't get behind Trump. But of course, the Democrats think that that's the best part of the Republican Party, that we're all the good Republicans that are standing up to Trump. So they've got that wrong. They don't understand that. The worst part, are you ready for this? The worst part of the Republican Party, why they're absolutely doomed, and this is a direct quote, when you look out over them, when you look out at them, it's just a bunch of white guys. That's it. Now, the irony was the three of us standing there are all white guys. OK, now I'm exemption because I'm not in Congress. I'm not an elected representative. But they got two white guys, both of them Democrats, right? Ben and this other man. And I did everything. Friends, I have to tell you, I was invited by a Democrat, and I was going to be on my absolute best behavior, which I was. I'm going to tell you right now, I was Mr. Charming himself. But I had to bite my tongue and do everything in my power to prevent myself from telling them or reminding them that it was Ben who, in Utah's 4th, as a white Democrat, male Democrat, unseated a black female, immigrant, can I add that to her life story? Republican! Folks, Democrats, these leftists are so far up in their bubble, they have no idea how ridiculous they are. So I just had to resort to a quiet, private chuckle. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rogowski, okay, in other AOC news, did you hear that she just put her boyfriend on her payroll? Yeah, this is a totally under the radar news story, and it seems to be absolutely legit. Now, the guy that posted an internal directory of staffers, of congressional staffers, that clearly has this Riley Roberts character listed as a staff member of AOC. He puts, well, first of all, the report comes out and it gets kind of poo-pooed on Twitter. So he goes and posts the original source document, which is a screen grab of this internal directory. And what happens? Twitter blocks him. Yeah, Twitter says, look, this is, you've published private information without third party consent. It's doxing, you know, I think is the colloquial term for it. And but regardless of the Twitter angle of the story, it appears to be legit. So what do you make of this? I don't know. I think if you're a congressman, congresswoman, congress thing, you can hire whoever the hell you want. I just hope they're good. And if they're not, if it's nepotism and you're just putting in useless people, in the end, that's going to bite you in the behind. So, you know, good luck with that. I just hope that he gets treated better than Amy Klobuchar's staff members. Have you heard about this? Amy Snowman Klobuchar, who announced this past week that she's running for president, touting a platform that will help combat global warming. At the same time, she's out there in a blizzard and looks like a Frosty by the time she's done giving her remarks. There are quite a few reports coming out from Capitol Hill that she abuses her staff, has them washing dishes at her residence, cleaning her laundry, has them... this is great. If they get fired or if they leave, this is if they leave, right? They say, enough, I am not hand washing your pantyhose, Senator Klobuchar. So then what she does is she basically sabotages any efforts, allegedly, right? This is all scuttlebutt, right? But this is from Democratic staffers, right? Very idealistic young people who are devoted to the left-wing causes, who go, you know, bright-eyed, starry-eyed to Capitol Hill. They're going to work for a senator. Tee-hee. And then they get there and realize it's indentured servitude. And not, I guess, the type of indentured servitude Ralph Northam speaks of. yes. So I think here's the plan. I think in all of this, it was very interesting being on Capitol Hill. I think you begin to understand how quickly the Beltway, right, the swamp, can get to you, and how quickly you become, if you will, part of that environment. Because it's, you know, just because it was a State of the Union, I mean, there were a lot of parties and shindigs, but there is something going on every night. And if you're a congressman, you basically are going from party to party, if you wish. You can go from party to party, and you become part of that world. And I think that if you're just an observation, I think if you're going to be a successful representative, you have to leave Washington regularly. You've got to go home. Washington, D.C. cannot become your primary residence with your district being number two. And the reason for this is it's an artificial world there. And you can get caught up in all the BS, and everywhere you turn as a lobbyist, as somebody that wants something from you. And everywhere you turn, your worth is being measured by how much power you wield and what committee assignments you have, what your rank is on a particular committee. Is your party in power or out of power? And it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter what success you have. Hell, it doesn't matter what kind of brain you've got in between your ears. It just matters how much power you exert. And the only way that that power matters is money. And it is a swamp filled with people that have their hand out. And this budget that just got passed, this $330+ billion budget that is putting our national debt in the stratosphere, is the best evidence of that to date. So, all right. Yeah, I don't know. People say, Sam, go into politics. I have no appetite for it whatsoever. Sam Rogowski, back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Rogowski, Sam Nation. Okay, I'll give you one clear example of why the swamp is the swamp. Well, or why, I'll say this, why Washington, D.C. is not a representation of the country. All right, so you look out over how the 2016 election has gone, okay, or how it went down. And you look at the Electoral College wins, you know, per state. And you see overall an enormous amount of red. And the red, if you will, roughly corresponds with the color of those MAGA hats that people are not allowed to wear anymore. And by the way, okay, let's not go with the Electoral College is a touchy subject for our friends on the left. So why don't we go with... Oh, let's go with the popularity contest. Let's go with Rasmussen polls or whatever. 45-55, 50-50, 54. Now you see the president is up 54 to 46, whatever it is. All right. There's a significant number of Americans that like the president. Now ask me how many MAGA hats I, your host, saw whilst in D.C. Well, not a lot. Wait a minute. I'm getting to that. So I didn't see any out and about, and I did a lot of walking. I didn't see any out and about. I saw a couple of tourists nervously take out their MAGA hats, put them on right in front of the White House, snap a selfie, and then put the hat back away. You know, because they watch mainstream media and have been informed that the MAGA hat is the new Ku Klux Klan hood, quote unquote. I'm paraphrasing CNN now, but just bear with me that it is, you know, it's unacceptable to wear. So then on the evening of the State of the Union speech, you know, I shared with you that I ended up inside Nancy Pelosi's office. I then go up into the gallery. I watch the speech. I hang out a little bit with Ben, do a quick podcast for him for something he was using in Utah. And then I come back to my hotel where I'm staying. Now, as a Trumpist, I could think of no better place to stay than the Trump International Hotel, the new hotel that Trump finished in 2016 that is the old post office building. It is a beautiful hotel, by the way. It is stunning and remarkably not too over-the-top Trumpish. I mean, there's gold, but not too much gold. So it was, it's a nice hotel. But I come there, I get there about 12:15 in the morning. So just past midnight. And the Capitol is already quiet. You know, the Democrats have all dispersed because they're in a fit of depression after the speech. Because, of course, Trump did awesome and he hit it out of the park. So they're all, you know, sledding down and not across. Well, I show up at the hotel lobby and there's a throng of people there. And I couldn't count the number of MAGA hats. So I have to tell you this. If you go to Washington, D.C., that's a friendly Sam Nation tip here. If you go to D.C. and you need a safe space to wear your MAGA hat, and I could recommend the lobby of the Trump International. Because that right there is where friends you can get. So I walk in. There's Peter King, the congressman from Republican congressman from Long Island, I think, right? And he's holding court in the lobby. There's a beautiful lounge, incredible bar. If you're into that thing, which I am, there's a beautiful bar. It kind of wraps around, comes out in a peninsula into the lounge area. Lots of seats around the bar. And I tell you, that party was going strong. So, yeah, I'll tell you, that was good stuff, and that was the place to be. So, yes, is D.C. representative of the country? No, of course not. And all of these people that exist off this ecosystem live off the largesse of the government. And the largesse of the government depends on the spendiness of members of Congress. And typically they benefit from insider rule, be it Republican or Democrat, where appropriations continue ad infinitum. So that's how that works. Sam Rogowski, I will be back after this short break.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rogowski, yesterday in Los Angeles, outside a synagogue, a security guard shot a lady in the leg. I guess I saw the whole video. I looked at the whole thing. This is insane. Rightfully today, the security guard was arrested. I mean, he's getting filmed. He doesn't like being filmed. The security guard clearly. I don't know who what agency hired him, but it just a crazy deal. Fires his gun at the person filming. He says it was a warning shot. That's not how it works. Certainly not in California. Okay, there's no such thing as a warning shot. And if there is a shot, it's a shot to kill, to stop. And you better damn well be within the within the law of permissible deadly force use. So nonetheless, there was an exchange that everyone missed, right? Because they're focusing on the shots getting fired. They're focusing on the aftermath and kind of the outrageousness of the story in general. But to me, there was this bit inside this long, was it 20-minute video that really goes to the heart of what a crap job police have in this country. So you've got to set this up correctly. You've got the person filming this is a YouTube celebrity star of sorts, goes by the handle Furry Potato. Her name is Zoe Perez, 45 years old. And, I know you can't see the video. I want you to just listen to it so you have this as a matter of first impression. Here we go.
It's going to be real bad if I go in cuffs. Everything's live streamed. 100% of it's live streamed. As a matter of fact, I got in the plaques all everything, too.
Where's your ID?
I don't carry ID on me.
You don't have any ID at all?
No. And I'm a transgender female as well, so I want to make sure who's putting hands on me.
Okay, who do you want to put hands on?
I'm a transgender female. We can figure it out.
I'm asking you right now. You're going to get searched. Do you want a female to search you, or do you want a guy to search you?
You know, I don't need your attitude, lady. I just got shot.
I'm asking you a question.
She's asking
I'm asking
you
a question.
You
who else searches females? Do you let guys search females? Can we keep it cool around that leg? Mind you, the guy that shot me is cool. He's just over there talking to the cops.
Okay. All right, so spoiler alert here. The lady looks like a man. All right? And so the cops arrive on the scene, and now they've got a dicey situation, right? Because they've got... They're arriving on the scene of a shooting, and they have somebody that isn't in a uniform and someone that is. And they don't know if there's a weapon. They don't know what's going on. Clearly, with the security guard, they know where the weapon is. The weapon's in his holster. They can assess that scene very easily. It's more difficult, if you will, to triage the other scene. You got a guy that shot a woman, excuse me, that shot in the leg. And it's not a terribly horrible bad injury, right? My understanding is she survives it. And they put her in handcuffs as a precautionary measure to do a search. And the first thing that she says is, I'm a transgendered female, which, by the way, I think you're supposed to say transgender is the correct term, but nonetheless. And the female officer, and I don't, how would you react? I'm putting it to you, right? Well, okay, ma'am, who do you want to search you? Do you want a female or a male? I'm just, tell me. This is uncharted territory for me. Maybe this officer's never done something like this. Maybe there's I don't know with what kind of training LAPD does, but I heard this in the sea of everything going on. I thought, here's a situation in LA where somebody just got shot. The officers are trying to assess the scene. They're worried that perhaps the person, the victim here, might have perpetrated some of this or may have brandished a weapon because. Rightfully so, it's pretty ludicrous that a security guard would shoot somebody unprovoked. And on top of that entire life and death assessment, these cops also have to worry about using the right pronouns and using the right gender for sex or gender of whatever who's performing the searches and doing everything correctly there, lest they end up in a pile of mess. Yeah, one more point on this, one finer point, if I may. This exchange sort of reminds me of that video that came out. We had it on the program a month ago or so, where you had the store clerk who was this teenage kid, and he calls a transgender female, sir, and the woman yells, it's ma'am. You remember this? You just assumed my gender. Isn't it kind of ironic here that the transgender female who's making a big deal of being transgender female actually assumes the gender of at least two people just in the short clip, right? She says, matter of fact, that guy in the black saw everything too. And then the guy who shot me is cool. He's just over there talking to the cops. I just want consistency. And the people that are demanding that all of us act at this very high level of sensitivity should live by the same rules that they wish to impose on the rest of us. I think that's fair. So let me know what you think. You know, the usual avenues, Twitter at Sam Nation, email sam@samnation.com, et cetera, et cetera. All right, back. I'll be back right after this. Don't go anywhere.
And now, ladies and gentlemen,
now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Marjowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Yeah, wow, 2 hours flying by here, and the weekend is close at hand. Before I leave you, I know that President Trump called Jim McCabe, Andy McCabe's wife, a loser to her husband's face. I wonder what he'd call Beto O'Rourke. Yeah, well, Wait, you have the distinction of losing a race to none other than Ted Cruz on a year where basically, I guess, half the voters out there don't like Trump and the other half that do like Trump hate your guts because you put a shiv in Trump at every chance you got, talking about Ted Cruz here back in the 2016 race. So Ted Cruz, the fact that Ted Cruz won that election, his re-election in 2018, and Beto lost is really a tribute to what a loser candidate Beto is. Anyway, Chris Hayes, MSNBC, is interviewing Beto O'Rourke, who's on this crusade to tear down the one piece of wall fencing that is near El Paso that used to be the most dangerous crossing in the country and has... It's gone from 250 daily crossings to one. That's the statistic, right? It's huge. And it's unbelievable. So that it's a huge deal. And anyway, so here's the interview. Chris Hayes asks O'Rourke about this and listen to the exchange.
Dan Crenshaw, who's a new member of Congress, he's been very outspoken in favor of the president's agenda on the border, particularly.
Right.
And he wanted to ask you, he tweeted this, if you could, would you take the wall down now, here?
Yes.
Like you have a wall.
Absolutely.
Like, knock it down.
I'd take the wall down.
And do you think the city, you think if there's a referendum here in this city, that would pass?
I do. Here's what we know. After the Secure Fence Act, we have built 600 miles of wall and fencing on a 2,000-mile border. What that has done is not in any demonstrable way made us safer. It's cost us tens of billions of dollars to build and to maintain, and it has pushed migrants and asylum seekers and refugees to the most inhospitable, the most hostile stretches of the U.S.-Mexico border, ensuring their suffering and death.
Okay. This is a lie. It's a bald-faced lie. Because everywhere where there is a border wall or a fence or a barrier or whatever, there is a demonstrable decrease in net crossings. Now, does it push people toward more inhospitable places, aka open areas of the desert? Probably. I don't disagree with him on that. But the way I read these numbers, 600 miles of fence and border, 2,000 miles of border, I just see it as we got 1,400 miles to go. I mean, that's the clear answer. And if migrants had to scale a 14-foot wall, 10-foot wall, 12-foot wall, 20-foot wall, whatever it is, they'd be rethinking the trip. And the net savings of lives would be enormous. Now, it's funny to me. He's such a lightweight. This guy is such an idiot. He's such a pansy. But he was trying to have a Reagan-esque moment in that rally that he had opposite of Trump in El Paso, where 3.5 people showed up, and his whole thing, yeah, his whole shtick was, you know, Mr. President, tear down this wall, echoing the words delivered by Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate in West Berlin. So I, first of all, let me point out that the Berlin Wall was very effective. I'll tell you this as the son of parents who were locked inside a country that was all but completely surrounded by barbed wire, borders kept people in. And those people, trust me, were highly motivated to escape. It was an interesting thing. You know, here we're building a border to keep people out. and to protect our citizens from getting overrun by illegal aliens. But in the minds of Democrats, they're making a terrible paradoxical mistake, right? They're using imagery of the Cold War, calling this wall that Trump is proposing as calling it immoral, right, and racist and all this stuff. And they're conflating tragically two very different scenarios, where the communist governments of Eastern Europe enslaved their populations, kept people from leaving their country. And that's a very different thing than us protecting our borders. But the other part of this, of course, is that that in drawing attention to these fences and walls that were all over Eastern Europe during the Cold War, just draws attention to their efficacy. And people did, in fact, those borders were very impossible to cross. And that is why stories of escape from Eastern Europe are written in history books and heralded as great acts of bravery, because they were so infrequent. The success rate was so low. All right, there we go. We'll follow all of this. This is going to be a fun week. This McCabe story is this interview is going to be very interesting, and we'll watch what Attorney General William Barr does as his first week in office as Attorney General commences Monday. Sam Rogowski here. Have a wonderful weekend. Thank you all for listening. Over and out.